Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
Asked me to speak this morning. I'm very humbled by that. I'll start with the beginning. You know, my sobriety date is June 7th of 2021. I have at one time had 15 years. I was a month shy of 15 years and went back out, and I'll talk about that a little bit. I have a home group. My home group is actually right now, Sunday morning, 10 a.m. in Mariposa. I've been going to that for a long time, and I have a sponsor, Randy from Mariposa. I'll give you a little bit of, you know, qualify what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'm originally from Southwest Washington State on the coast. I come from a huge Irish Catholic family. I have 13 aunts and uncles and 48 first cousins. I joke that when I want to see how they're doing, I watch the TV show Cops. My dad was a logger. My dad's father was a boxer. And they were all combat vets. So they're very stoic people. And they all had this ability to work like 12-hour days, then drink, and then get 4 hours of sleep, and then go back to work. And they would say things like, we work during the week for money, and then we work on the weekends for fun. They just were working all the time. But they didn't ever talk about feelings. And every time I was very little, I was the firstborn in my family. I have a younger brother. There was a lot of domestic violence. And it was just the same thing over and over and over and over again, where my dad would be out drinking, my mom had made him dinner, he'd come home late, she would be pissed off. He would just be laughing, and then she'd like chuck the plate at him, and then they'd start trying to kill each other. So it was a lot of just chaos from a very young age, where I'd come home and there would be nobody at the house, or my mom would take prescription medication and be asleep for 3 days. So you're really kind of on your own, and we were really out in the middle of nowhere. So it was about a half a mile to the next neighbor. So there's a lot of times where you just didn't know what to do. Like there would be no food, so you'd have to be in like the neighbor's garage trying to get dog food, kibble out of their garage. And you're just kind of on your own. And it wasn't a lot of people I really trusted, although I came from a huge family. And there's pictures of me when I'm very little. I'm just like 2 years old, and I've got a Rainier beer that I'm like downing behind a door. And they of course, just thought it was funny. There was nothing wrong about drinking. So at 11 years old, my folks divorced. And at 12, I was removed from my mom by Child Protective Services for neglect. So I went and stayed with an aunt for a year. And this is right about the time I started drinking and smoking cigarettes. And the first time I ever drank for effect, I had two beers. And I wasn't really liking the taste so much. I went into the bathroom to take a leak. When I looked in the mirror, I saw James Bond looking back at me. And I just had this transformation of who I was with before and then were just very stark. And that I loved that feeling. So up to that point, I was very mousy. You know, I just kind of tried to avoid people. I was afraid of my dad and the men in my dad's side of the family. And I didn't have much confidence. I didn't have any esteem. But when I drank, I had those missing qualities. I've heard it said, you know, that drinking does something to us and something for us. And I'm very aware of what that is. So when I was about 12 years old, and I had a couple drinks. Let me back up and say one more thing. So in my dad's side of the family, me and my brother, my dad, my grandfather, when we're not drinking, they call us ornery. And I know exactly what they're talking about. It's like we're very irritable, very serious, and you just kind of stay away from folks. And I can always tell when my father's passed away from drinking now, but I could always tell when they were drinking because they'll start humming or singing. Like it's very transformative from being ornery to being, you know, sociable. So anyway, I had a couple drinks. I never said anything to my dad. I just avoided confrontation. He was very big into disrespect. If you disrespect him, you're going to get hit. So I'd had a couple of beers, and I had no intent of saying anything to him. And I just walked into the room. He was in the garage. He had a wood lathe and he was working on something. And fortunately for me, he'd probably had a couple drinks. But as I walked in, I said, "Sometimes you're really an asshole." And he chuckled and he said, "You're probably right." And so if I had not been drinking, I would never would have said that. But the thing that also surprised me was his reaction. It was not what I thought it would be. So there was this thing with alcohol where it got me to do things I would never do sober. And then sometimes the reaction I got out of people was far better than I'd ever anticipated. So it made me kind of bold, made me more confident. But that wasn't always the case. So there were times I was pretty young. I was visiting family. It must have been like Easter or Thanksgiving at my grandma's. There must have been 30 people there. And I had gone to Safeway and I had shoplifted MD-2020. And I drank the whole bottle. And if you haven't ever had it, it's a cross between like paint thinner and cough syrup. And so after I downed this bottle, I kind of was in a quasi blackout. And I don't know where I got this idea, but my family's very, very religious. So I started telling horribly sexually inappropriate jokes in front of my grandma just to see her face go red. And I was the only one laughing. I just thought this was hysterical. So they were trying to get me outside to stop this. The next thing I know, I'm like, they had a dog leash in the front yard. And so they had me hogtied in the front yard. And then my grandfather is trying to lay hands on me to pray and cast out demons. And there's people driving by going, "Holy shit, what the hell's going on there?" And as they're trying to touch me, I'm like trying to bite them. And so my cousins, like 3, 4, 5, 6 on the stairs, they're all crying. They're just traumatized by this, which is actually the only part that really bothers me. So it wasn't every time that I drank that crazy shit happened, but whenever crazy shit happened, I had been drinking. So I lived with my aunt for about a year. She had really strict rules, which I liked. She was very Catholic. You had to wake up at 4, do chores. She had a ranch and a farm, and she had a couple rules. I wasn't supposed to smoke, I wasn't supposed to drink, I wasn't supposed to cuss, which I did. And so I had to go to church, had to go to school. I was there about a year, and they were going away for something, her and her husband, and they said, "Okay, there's two rules. You can't drink our booze and you don't drive the truck." And I was only like 13 at the time. And of course, that's what I did. They had a bottle of Cutty Shark, which I drank as soon as they left. And then it was in the middle of the winter, and I hadn't driven a truck very often. So I didn't even get a quarter of a mile, and I slid the truck off the road in the ice into a bank and wrecked the truck. And so when they got back, they took me to be with my dad. My dad had been injured in the woods, and he was just kind of a wreck at this time. He'd gotten like 3 DUIs in like the space of 6 months. So I was formally taken in and made a ward at the court. And I moved around a lot. Between the time I went in to when I graduated high school, I'd gone to 22 different schools. And there were, you know, a lot of things that went wrong were some of my doing. When people wanted me to be like a family member, I just kind of ran away from that. When people were just kind of like, you know, "These are the rules, be in by 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. or you're locked out for the night," I totally got along well with those kind of things. I didn't want to, you know, be someone's family member. I just wanted to kind of get through things and have kind of a wall up. So I don't think that the trauma in my life made me an alcoholic. In fact, I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. The thing that's really fascinating to me is I'm the only person in my family that's in recovery. And I'm sure the reason is because these things accelerated me. You know, I had to kind of drink more and more and more to get the same effect. So it kind of sped things up. And everybody else, they have this ability to do what my dad did, which is drink and then get passed out for 4 hours and go to work. And they're still doing domestic violence. I go and visit my younger brother. I walk in to his house at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and he's passed out in bed, and his 7-year-old daughter is drawing on the walls with magic marker. And I said, "Hey, Joey, your daughter's drawing on the wall with magic marker." And he said, he doesn't even look up at me. He just says, "Is it really magic? Can it cast spells?" It's just this, you know, the chaos. Anyway, I totally get it. I understand all that. I love those folks. My dad passed when I was pretty young. He died from liver and kidney failure. I was with him when he died. And, you know, I hated my dad. I was really afraid of him. But when he died, I kind of connected that there's this person and then there's this person with this problem. I wasn't really understanding what alcoholism was at that point. But I had more issues with my mom and forgiving my mom and not really understanding, you know, or being able to understand what had gone on. That she got diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. But for a long time, I just took everything that they had done very personally. It wasn't until I got into recovery that I kind of realized that, God, they did the best they could with what they had, and they actually kind of gave me a marginal life better than what they had. And I think that's all I could expect from them. So it wasn't until I got into recovery that this transformation began, happened, where I was able to forgive and let go and then kind of focus on myself. So the first time I went to treatment, I was 12 years old. And at that time, which was 1983 in Portland, Oregon, they didn't actually think a 12-year-old could be an alcoholic. So that I'm not sure if it was the insurance company or if it was the treatment center. There was this debate about whether I should be able to go or not. And I at that time, I had no desire whatsoever to stop drinking. It was working for me. And, of course, this happened to me several times. But whenever I went in someplace, what happened is then I learned all the stuff I didn't know from the other inpatients about how to hotwire cars or all these other drugs I'd never used before. So it was always kind of this educational experience. So one of the things in my case that was, there's been times where I'm like, I feel like I'm crazy and the drinking is definitely a problem, but the crazy is more of a problem. And it wasn't just drinking, it was this whole lifestyle. You know, like the people in my life, the people that were close to me, it's kind of like the mob. Like, you're not getting out. You're not leaving these people. You know, they show up at your house at 2 a.m. and they're like, hey, I got a bench warrant out for me. I need to crash at your place. You can't tell them no. So it just kind of seemed like you're not getting out of this, you know. So the idea of not drinking or not using just never came into my mind. You know, it was kind of this survival. And there was definitely a progression. You know, I started off with two cold beers in cups. And when I stopped drinking, I was drinking room temperature vodka right out of the bottle. You know, it's just where it was at. And when I would have these crazy thoughts of maybe I need to like kind of cut down a little bit, I was like, maybe I should pour water in the vodka and kind of like help cut it down a little bit, and then maybe that'll help me not have such bad hangovers the next day too. It's just utter insanity. When I first came to AA, it was about 1983. I think they took me in. I went to a treatment center and when I was 13 too. And I remember the old timers very well, and they'd say these things. In the Pacific Northwest, they were kind of gruff, very big book thumpers, but they'd say like, you know, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop drinking and you want help, that's AA. And I remember it very clear. So it was about this time in the Pacific Northwest, psychedelic mushrooms grow naturally. And I had met these two guys who were just hippies that had trash bags full of mushrooms. And so everybody that I met felt sorry for me. I really... at that time, manipulating people with this tragic story, and it was a tragic story, but it didn't help me at all. You know, just people would enable me to kind of keep doing what I was doing. So anyway, I overdosed on mushrooms. I laughed for like 36 hours straight, which was really painful, and then I just stopped talking. And so they put me into a psych ward. This is the first psych ward, but wasn't my last. And at this point in Washington State, they didn't have juvenile psych wards, so they put me in the adult psych ward, which was fine with me because they let me smoke, which is to say I could bum cigarettes off of the other patients in there. So I was in there for about 3 days, and these two men showed up in suits. They looked like they were from the Mormon Church or something. I that's what I thought originally. And they were talking to the charge nurse, and the charge nurse pointed them at me, and I just had no idea what was going on. So they came in, and they talked to me, and I said, well, whatever this is, you're going to have to give me a cigarette if you want me to listen. So they gave me a cigarette, and they were talking about drinking, and then they asked me, they said, hey, do you think you have a problem with drinking? And I said, you have no idea what it's like. I said, you know, if you had my life, it's just, I'm insane, and if I can get that dealt with, you know, then I don't think I'll have any other problems. And they said something I'll never forget. They said, okay, they said, you've helped us more than we've helped you. And they got up to walk away. They never said anything. I said, I don't think you're trying hard enough. What are you trying to sell? And they said, we're not trying to sell you anything. They said, well, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's this God shot that will come back later when I said, you have no idea what it's like. I will fast forward. I got sober when I was 25, and my sponsor would drag me to detox meetings all the time. And I was always like just Oscar the Grouch. I was always the bad cop. I was like, these people don't want to get sober. This is wasting my time. I don't know why you're here. They all smell. This is ugly. I just everything that was coming out of it was totally negative. Anyway, there was like three people from AA at this detox. We're in North Seattle. There's probably like 16 people. Like five were awake. And so we tell our stories. And at the end of that, this guy who'd been awake, he was covered in dry vomit. He had urine, dried urine on him. And he looked miserable. And at the end of the meeting, you know, we're kind of standing around. I'm just ready to go. And I'm dressed right like I am right now. And this guy said, he looked at me and he said, you have no idea what it's like. And I was so struck by that. I put my arm on him and I said, you're not alone, my friend. I see this over and over. There's kind of this foreshadowing, you know, of things that are going to happen. So I started going to AA, but the way I did it is, and I should say that some of this was court ordered. You know, I was getting minors in possessions. I got a DUI. So when I did go, I would sit right by the door. When they would, in the middle of a meeting, I would get up and go smoke outside. And then when they would get up to do the Lord's Prayer at the end, I would just leave. And I'd been doing this for years. And one time, this gentleman, old timer from inside, he came out when I was smoking, and his name's Bev. And he said, how's AA working for you, Paul? And I said, not very good. You guys haven't done much for me. And he said, you know, Paul, AA is not Jiffy Lube. He said, you're only going to get out of it what you put into it. And he said, I'm just going to give you a suggestion. He said, if you don't have a 12 and 12, get the 12 and 12 and read Step 10 and read St. Francis' Prayer. And I said, well, I'm very anti-religious. And he said, you know, so am I. He said, go read it. And it was kind of this introduction to me. I'd been raised very Catholic. And so I'm not saying anything against religion. I had to kind of unlearn what I thought I knew about things. And it was this process. And one of the things that really had to happen for me is, you know, I would sit in the rooms of AA and I'd be like, none of you have been where I have been. None of you experienced the things I've experienced. And so somehow it just felt like it didn't apply to me. And so it took me a long time before I heard someone tell my story. And he's still in my life today. His name's Al. He was sharing at a meeting. He was an airborne ranger and he shattered his foot. And so he was out. And he was sharing at his first meeting, he had about 3 years sober at that time, that he had challenged the whole group to a fight. And at the smoke break, the biggest guy, he was from New York, his name's Kenny, he came up and put his hand on his shoulder and said, you're in the right place, keep coming back. And and I was so impressed with Al, because when I came in the rooms of AA, I hated all of you. You were laughing. I just felt like, God, if you had my problems, you wouldn't be laughing about stuff. You know, this is so far removed from where I came from. But that pissed offness about everything with him, I totally related. And so he had been through everything I had been through. He'd been through foster care, he was raised Catholic, all of that shit. And so I remember listening to him tell a story, and there was two things that happened that were kind of transformative. The first thought I had is, oh my God, if that guy's an alcoholic, then so am I, because I think exactly like that, and I've done everything he's done. And then the second thought I had, oh my God, if that knucklehead could get sober, so can I. And so I asked him, I said, I didn't know really what sponsorship was, but I said, show me what you've done and I'll do it. And he said, come, we're going to go for a drive, which really scared me. He was a big guy, he's like 6'3". And he's kind of German, so he's buff. So anyway, we're in his Saab driving around, he's telling me his story, and then he has me tell me my story. And in the middle of this, he says, you know, Paul, I can't get you sober. And I said, great, I've got a retarded AA member. I said, well, you better find me someone who can. And he said, that's what the steps are for, Paul. They're going to put you in touch with the power greater than alcohol. And I really liked this wording of things because it helped me not get hung up on the religious angle. Because whatever I saw God or any, it's just like this wall went up. And I said, well, you're going to have to boil down. What is AA? What do I have to do? Like, I make it simple for me. And he said, well, he said, just for today, you're going to, you know, not drink. You've got to find a power greater than you and pray to it. And you have to be of service. And I thought about this and I said, well, I can only do one of those things. So you're going to have to pick one. And he laughed. It seemed impossible to me then. Today, it's not such a tall order. You know, it's this gradual kind of awakening. The service that I'm involved in today, I actually really find very satisfying and rewarding. So it's not like I feel put out by it at all or anything like that. Anyway, what I love so much about the steps and working through the steps is I had this wall up where I did not trust anybody. I did not let anybody in. And it wasn't until I worked the steps with another man that I got really vulnerable for the first time ever. So what I did, the people that I was with, they did not, he said, we're going to meet every Sunday at IHOP, and I'm going to read to you out of the big book, we're going to work the steps. We went through it very quickly. And part of what I believe and what I understand was they were saying, you know, if you want to have the freedom from the torment, from this, the restless, irritable, discontent when we're not drinking, you've got to use this program, the 12 steps, which to me are just this roadmap of how to get there. And I totally believed him. I'm like, you know, I could see how it's working in your life. And one of the magical things that he had several things that were really impressive to me. One is he did not feel sorry for himself at all about anything. And I was so baffled by this. I remember I would be talking to him and I'd say, you know, like I always do, I just, you know, was a victim and stuff. And he would say, wow, 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 poor Paul, a drink. And I just wanted to sock him. I was so pissed off. And then I realized what I was doing. I wasn't even aware of how much self-pity I had until someone was kind of showing it back to me. So when we went through the steps, I remember he would have me write. I was doing the fourth step. We were at IHOP. And I said, it's the first time I was ever really honest with someone about what's going on inside my head. I said, I think I'm doing something wrong because I still think about drinking. And he didn't even put down the paper. He said, Paul, you wouldn't be an alcoholic if you didn't think about drinking. And I remember we were going through the first step, and this happened to me quite a bit, is he'd read for like 30 seconds, and then I was like off into left field. And he saw that I wasn't listening anymore. He's like, what's going on? What's happening here? And I said, well, I figured out what I need. What I need is I got to fix my car. I got to get a job. I got to fix things with my partner. And then I think it'll all be good. And he nodded, and he said, sure. He said, Paul, the only thing you know how to do is get drunk, and when I want your opinion on that, I'll ask you. And I was so pissed off. I wanted to sock him in the nose, but I realized, oh, my God, that's kind of true. And so it was this thing of, like, all of my ideas, I know my ideas, and I trusted my ideas, but they all led to naught. They all kind of got me to places that I don't want to go anymore. You know, it's this first step of I'm powerless and have this powerless, out of control, unmanageability. The unmanageability is my ego and my self-will. I've heard it said in many AA meetings, and I really like it, that the alcoholism, the ism is I sponsor myself. If I get out away from this thing and from recovery, I just start kind of drifting into weirdness, you know, where I start imagining hurts or making things worse than they really are. And that's how I get in trouble, is when I get kind of separated from people, disconnected from people. Anyway, I was so scared about doing the fifth step. When I did the fifth step, I did it in code, so nobody can understand it but me. And I figured he'd been in jail, so I actually embellished some things because I wanted to impress him. I didn't want him to think I was a wimp. And I started out by telling him, I said, you're going to have to share a secret with me. I'm not going to trust you until that happens. So the secrets that I had carried with me, you know, weren't necessarily things I had done when I was drunk. And I, you know, I've done stupid stuff in recovery too that I've had to go back and I can do stupid stuff sober or drunk. Anyway, one of the things that always had haunted me when I was a little boy, we had a feral cat on our property that gave birth to a bunch of kittens. My mom put him in a gunny sack and she tied him and she said to me, go down to the creek and drown him. And I was so afraid of telling my mom no that I went and did it. And they put up a struggle. I killed him. But the part that later on haunted me is like, why didn't I just set him free? Why did I follow through on this? So these things that had happened, and like the story I told you about being hogtied by my grandparents, it just was like another thing in this category of like, there's something wrong with me. I'm a bad person. If you really knew who I was, you wouldn't like me. It just kept kind of seeing reaffirming these things. And then when I would wake up and I was sober, I was just like, God, I don't want to feel like this. So it was this endless cycle of self-obsession. And there's a lot of little sayings early on that I really loved. One of them I used to hear a lot was, you know, my mind's like a bad neighborhood. Don't go in alone and don't stay too long. When I was doing the fifth step with Al, we went through all of these things. He asked me, like, what are your five biggest secrets right off the top? And we went through it. And at the end of this, I've never felt so vulnerable in my life. There was just kind of this awkward pause. And he said, Paul, there's nothing you've done that I haven't done or that alcoholics haven't done. He said, you're no different than any of us. You know, he said, you're not a bad person trying to get good. You're just a sick person trying to get well. And he said, I don't know what's going to happen to you. You may drink tomorrow. You may end up going to jail. He said, but no matter what, I'm going to fucking love you. And it was like my higher power was speaking directly to me for the first time. I kind of felt like someone had punched through my wall. I just didn't care about people. I wouldn't say that I was sociopathic, but I remember just sitting in AA for a long time with my arms folded. And I was at this meeting I've been going to for a long time. And they called on this kid. I never saw him before or since. And they asked him to share. And he said, I don't know what to say. I heard so fucking bad and I can't stop drinking. And I started crying. I just had this empathy. I knew exactly where he was. And that was kind of the first time my wall started coming down with people, where I started caring about other people. And it was, at that time, it was only other alcoholics that I cared about. Eventually, it got easier and easier to kind of let down. So the group of people that I was with at this time, I was 26 years old. They didn't ask me if I wanted to be in service. They would just show up at my house and say, hey, get in the truck. We're going to go paint this guy's house. And at the time, I was really put off by this. I thought this was just, how dare they? Like but in hindsight, I really appreciated that if I didn't have adult supervision, I would always end up in trouble. And it just kind of felt like they put me in their back pocket. And they took me to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. That first year, it was only one day I didn't get to a meeting, and most days I went to two or three meetings a day. But they would show up and they'd say, okay, you've got 60 days, we're going to take you into this. There was a place called Northern State, and it's a hospital for habitual offenders. And if you go in, you can be there as long as the state wants. They may never release you again. So there's wet brains, there's people that have like 31 DUIs. So I'm going with my sponsor. He's a combat vet from Vietnam. He's got 22 years of sobriety, and this other lady, her name was Verona, both of these folks are dead. She had like 18 years of sobriety. I'm in the back seat. I'm very scared. He's got this SUV, and he's playing Jethro Tull at 10, so I can't really hear much of what they're saying. I just hear flute. His wife had an affair with somebody else in the program, so he keeps pulling this gun out from under his seat, and he's named this gun Skippy, and he's going to kill this guy who's having the affair. And he's talking to me while we're weaving back and forth in traffic, and at the same time, this lady has a one of those magazines like the National Enquirer, and there's pictures of Jesus in the clouds, and she said, Jesus is coming back, Jesus is coming back. I thought, oh my God, we're the people trying to carry the message to the crazy people in this place. This is nuts. And so we go in there, and it's scary as hell. I mean, it's, you know, the place was originally built in the 1800s, and, you know, some of the people are just drooling, you know, they're not even really conscious, but there are some folks that are just normal people, and we go in, we share our stories, and we come out, and I was so scared of everything. When I got back, I called my sponsor and said, what the hell were you thinking, dude? Like, you know, these people are nuts. And he said, did you think about drinking? And I said, no. And he said, that's the whole point, Paul. You know, there's a lot of these little things that I find really funny, but I came in here and I hated everybody, and the more I worked the steps, the more you people changed. It's just this really subtle shifts about stuff. So there's something transformative about the steps. There were some things that I had done. When I was 15, I was drinking with a group of people, all also teenagers, and we had gotten drunk in a cemetery. There was about five of us. And somebody pushed somebody, and when they fell, they knocked over a tombstone. And then we got this idea in our head, let's just push over tombstones. So we pushed over all the tombstones in the cemetery, and we got busted. And the press, they were like, there's a bunch of devil worshipers. And I was still drunk. I got arrested, went up to South Bend in the county seat for Pacific County, Washington State. It's about an hour south of Aberdeen. When I was there, so it was a felony charge because of the cost to replace all of the headstones was going to be more than $2,500 per person. So the prosecuting attorney was standing next to me. I had a public defender, and he was saying disparaging things about my family. So I spit on him, and I didn't think much of it. And 6 years later, I was driving down to that county visiting family, and I had actually been out drinking the night before, and I went home and I crashed for 5 hours and got up and I was driving back to Seattle. And I got caught speeding on the way, and they did a breathalyzer, and I was over the legal limit. And I was very furious, because I'm like, this is me sober, dude. You should have caught me last night. Like, this is not fair. Anyway, I had to go back to South Bend. When I go into South Bend, the judge is twirling the gavel, and he says, Mr. Rogers, I've been waiting for this day. And I'm trying to piece together what's going on here, and I'm like, holy crap, that judge was the prosecuting attorney, and he remembers me. And I'm like, this is not going to go well. And it didn't. But when I did the ninth step, making amends, what I love about the sponsorship I had is, you know, they say do direct amends, but they had me write out my three worst amends first. They said, write it out, and then you're going to read it to me. And I totally understood what they said. You know, an amends is if you stole 20 bucks, you're going to give them back 20 bucks. So all three of my letters essentially said, I'm sorry, but it's not my fault. And so I read it to him, and he said, that's not what an amends is, Bob. He said, you know, if you're going to tell them, hey, I damaged your fence, how can I replace it? What can I do to make it up for you? And you're going to add on there, is there anything else I've done that I need to make right? And other than doing the fifth step, that was very vulnerable for me. You know, but anyway, what I'm going with this is very transformative. I did that with that judge. And I said, hey, you know, I can't take it back. It was disrespectful what I did. I apologize for that. If there's anything I could do to make it right, let me know. And years go down the road, and I decide that I want to work for the federal government. And in order to do that, I have to quash that felony from the 15 when I was 15. And so it was in college at the time, and I had the letters that professors had written me to get into grad school. And I had some folks that knew me from AA, my sponsor. And I sent him those letters, and I said, hey, this is a situation. I want to go to work for the federal government. I've been clean and sober for this amount of time. And he called me up, and he said, not only will I quash it, there was some misdemeanors, and he's like, I'm going to take all those away. And he says, Paul, I know where you came from, and I'm very proud of you. So what I want to convey is the transformative nature of this thing had been a negative in my life. As a result of working the steps, it became this positive. You know, these things... Sometimes in life we get to these dead ends and we're just like, I don't know what to do at this point. And then if I'm working the program I should be, sometimes these things open up. I had no idea it would ever happen. So to give you an example of this, I was married for 16 years and I had a starter wife. When I was 17, I got married to somebody and we divorced when I was 21. I called her my starter wife. At that time, I was going to another program, and she got together with my sponsor. And so it was just another thing of, like, I can't trust women, blonde women particularly. And then I was like, God, I had the worst sponsor ever, you know. We were trying to have a baby. And I'm like, I know I'm okay because my starter wife had a miscarriage. So after a couple of years, she goes in to get checked, and she's like, I'm good to go. You're going to have to go get checked. I'm like, oh, I know I'm good to go. So we go in, I get checked, she's with me, the two doctors come in, they're looking at the floor, which is always a bad sign. And they said, yeah, you don't have any swimmers. And I said, well, I must have because my starter wife had a miscarriage. And they said, yeah, that wasn't yours. And I'm like, oh, God damn it, that hurt. And so they said, but if you have, your insurance doesn't cover it, there's in vitro fertilization, it costs about $28,000. Well, I was in my 20s. I don't have $28,000. So, and then my in-laws were pressuring me to adopt a kid. And I'm like, I think the universe is trying to tell me to just let my bloodline die. Like, you know, this is, I think something is, I just don't want to do this. And I just accepted this, you know, this outcome. I had wanted kids and my wife wanted kids at that time. And then 2 years later, I wasn't asking. I A family friend stepped in and gave us $30,000 and said, have a kid. And we did in vitro fertilization, and I have a daughter. I have a 16-year-old daughter as a result of that. And these things have happened more than once in my life. In 2019, things were going really downhill for me. I wasn't sure what was going on. I was having trouble with my vision. I was having seizures. And I thought I had dementia. And so I was becoming really depressed. And I researched my life insurance, and they're like, if you're over 2 years and you commit suicide, we'll still pay out, so I was golden. And I was like, I can't embarrass my daughter, so I have to make it look like it was an accident somehow. Because I was in a lot of pain. And it's kind of like the frog in the hot water where you don't realize what's happening until you get to this point where it's really unbearable. And I went into the doctor, and they had me go see a neurologist. And I still was just waiting for him to confirm I had dementia. And I got a really good neurologist, and she caught it right away that I have multiple sclerosis. And so she got me into treatment within 6 months. The way my insurance works is you're supposed to start off with lesser, cheaper drugs, and then if they don't work, then you can move up to better ones. And she went out and fought that and got me one of the better ones right off the bat, because I was at the point where I was not able to read as well anymore. And I was feeling like, when I got that diagnosis, I kind of felt like, you know, things are just going to progressively get worse from this stage. Like, there was this terrifying feeling that if things are bad now, it's only going to get worse. And then when I saw other people had MS, they're all, like, immobile or wearing diapers, like, they're not having sex. I'm like, all these things are just bad news. Like, I just... and then, of course, like, you know, there's this self-pity of like, God, I'm an alcoholic and now I have MS. It just seems like the universe is picking on me. And I tell my sponsor, I said, if there is a God, he has it out for me. And I said, you know, I had a horrible family and then I'm an alcoholic. And without a missing a beat, he says, Paul, you're the only person in your family who graduated from college, and you're the only person in your family who's in recovery. So I'd say God really had it out for you. And it's always fascinating to me, how can both of these things be true at the same time? This perspective of stuff. Where I work, it's about a 45 minute commute home. And usually by the time I'm leaving, I'm very tired. I'm usually hungry. And it's like when I'm alone in my mind, I go through the day and I'm like, I think that person was insulting me. So, you know, I start kind of doing this thing where I make myself agitated. So as I'm driving home, I'm like, that place burned up. I'm like, I don't like that restaurant, it's for bad food. I'm like, that guy's definitely a drug dealer. So I drive this road, I go home and I eat, and then on the same road, I go to an AA meeting. After I leave the meeting, I'm driving home, I'm like, oh, there's a beautiful sunset. There's a happy couple holding hands. I'm like, oh, I really like the food there. And it dawns on me, holy crap, the only thing that's changed is Paul. Like, the way I see the world, you know, my attitude is so different. And a lot of that is the simple things, like the halt, the hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know, what am I doing that I have power over to make my life better? And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I talk about gratitude and being thankful. And there are plenty of things in life that suck. And there's so much of my recovery that it has not been easy. It's choosing between bad and worse. And it's oftentimes that way at work, too. And it's like, why do I have to be the one that has to make these choices or do this thing? So, you know, so much of recovery for me is just this routine. I think of the Karate Kid and the wax on and the wax off, where my sponsors early on, they just kind of beat it into me. Go to a meeting every day. You're going to get the big book. You're going to read it. You're going to pray to something you don't believe in. And you're going to call other people on the program, leave a message, or socialize with them. And as a result of doing that, there are many times where I think, oh, I'm not going to go to a meeting tonight. I'm just too tired. And my car is on autopilot. It just goes to the meeting. And when I go to that meeting, I'm just like, oh, I'm just agitated. I don't like these people anymore. They're pissing me off. And then somebody beside me is having a much worse day than me. And I suddenly realize, like, God, all of my problems are kind of catalog problems compared to this. Like, I am not having to face, you know, the drinking, drugging thing today by the grace of AA. And it happened to me, I went to a MS support group, and when I got there and everybody's in wheelchairs, I'm like, God, I have like the good version of MS. Like, I have a lot to be grateful for. So it's this perspective and this attitude that I have a part in. And so the fascinating thing to me, the spirituality about AA and everything, is that in these times where I want to be comforted, where I want someone to come to me and say, hey, it's going to be okay, we'll get through this, that's the times I have to reach out to other people and do it and comfort them. And when I do that, it gets me out of my head. And, you know, the reason I know I'm an alcoholic is that when I don't drink, I have torment. I just torment myself. And so the whole thing in here for me, the 12 steps, the spiritualness, is how to get freedom from that torment. Like, you know, I early on, I thought, you know, if I work these steps, I'm going to be like a spiritual Buddha, and I'll write a self-help group, and I'll have groupies. And then I thought, I'm like, I must be doing something wrong, because I just don't feel happy or blissful all the time. And so I told my sponsor, I said, I think I'm doing something wrong, because I just don't feel spiritual. And he said, Paul, spirituality is not a feeling, it's an action. If you're being honest, if you're being of service, if you're trying to right-size your ego and forgive, then you're being spiritual. And this was really radical to me, you know, this whole idea of what spirituality was, how it applies to me. And I can't, it's humorous, but I would have these moments when I was first sober where I was just trying to figure stuff out. That I remember I was walking down the street, it was rainy, and I sometimes would have these weird things happen, and it might have been the early onset of MS, where I'd have like these muscle spasms and this weird sensation. I'm like, this must be the universe trying to tell me something, you know? So I'm looking around everywhere, like, what's the universe trying to tell me? And all I see is like this plastic spork on the ground. And so I'm like, huh, that's weird. So I keep walking, and then that happens to me again. I'm like, I think it's telling me to do something with this. So I go, I pick it up. I carry this thing around me for a week. I'm trying to figure out, like, what's the significance of this, you know? And so I tell my sponsor finally, I'm like, I'm not getting it. You know, like, I feel like there's a spiritual experience and the higher power is trying to tell me something. And he said, okay. And he said, did you figure it out? And I said, no. And he said, well, I know what it is. And I said, okay, what? And he said, you should pick up litter. It really is that simple. I think when I tried so hard, it was so elusive to me. And yet when I stopped trying to figure it out, it's amazing to me. There's people I work with that'll say, they've known me for a long time. I've had the same career for 25 years. They'll say, Paul, you're the most spiritual person I've ever met. And I'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. Everything you hear out of me is 100% AA. There's nothing coming out of me other than that. So there is something here that works that I don't see in myself, but I see it in others. You know, I can't convey enough that this program works for people who are willing to do the footwork. When I lived in Seattle, I had the great benefit of one of the best AA meetings of all time was West Seattle. It's called the Fremont Hall, which was just the Jerry Springer show of AA. That was right next to a bar. And so on any given day, like a quarter of the people in there were drunk. And there was so much smoke and so much side talk that you could barely hear the people speaking. And the people speaking would usually, the old timers, dress really nice. And they would bang on the tables and they would say, work the steps or die. I lost my train of thought with this. But I'll have to come back to it. So I know I've kind of, I had 14 years, 11 months of sobriety. I was going through a divorce in about 2010, and I broke my back. And when I broke my back, I got put on opioids. And I was on opioids for a while, and I was still trying to go to a meeting, but I couldn't drive while I was on opioids. I had been going, even at this time, I was going to a couple meetings a week. I had a service position, although it was really a distant service position. It was like archivist or lending library or something like this. So I went to the business meeting like once a month. So when this happened, I told my doctor, I said, I think I'm getting dependent on the opioids. So they immediately cut me off. So then I sought out other ways. And I was out for a period of time. It was hard for me to come back. And during that stage, it was not only had things progressed, it was just kind of craziness. Like, I would be drinking cough syrup and taking drugs, and but why, I have no idea. And so I would end up getting psychosis, and they would put me in a psych ward. And I remember being in a psych ward, and this is up by Vancouver, Portland, and I had been going to AA, so everybody in AA knew me. And they were, once they found out I was in the psych ward that relapsed, they were, had people come up every night. You're only supposed to have two visitors per night, but I routinely had three or four people a night that came up and saw me. And I felt very loved by this. And at the, I was there for about 12 days, and about day 10, this African-American nurse, she said, "You have the most family support I've ever seen." And I said, "None of those folks are my family. They're all from AA." And she says, "Trust me when I tell you, those are your family." So flash forward, I got sober again. You know, one of the things that I know, I don't encourage anybody to pick up or use again. I'm not trying to ever say that, but I, you know, if you do go out after time, there's this pride thing of like, oh my God, you know, I don't want to have to face these people or admit what I've done. But I found AA members to be so loving, you know, and supportive of me when I came back. It was never judged or used against me or anything like that. So I kind of feel like the universe was right-sizing my ego. It's funny to me, sometimes I'll be at a meeting and a newcomer will be like, "God, it sounds like you have a lot more time than you do." And I'm like, "Yeah, it's funny how that works." And then when I got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, all my doctors know I'm a recovering alcoholic. I volunteered that right away. But as soon as I got that diagnosis, they're just like, "Here's morphine, here's this, here's," I'm like, "No, no." But I, during that transition, I started using benzodiazepines and I got dependent on them. I was going through just a terrifying time of feeling like I was going to kill myself. I couldn't deal with this. I couldn't cope with waking up the next day and finding out I couldn't walk or something. And during this time, it happened to be during the pandemic, so it was difficult to get to meetings. I was doing the Teams thing all the time. And in the midst of this, I was single, and I knew this woman who'd been in recovery. She'd gone through a divorce, and through a fluke, we met. Her kids used to watch my daughter. And so I thought we'll just be friends because I'm lonely as hell during the pandemic. She's a nurse. So she came over, and I was kind of trying to warn her off. I'm like, I think this is kind of trouble. Like, I think I'm on the verge of killing myself, and it's just more than I can bear. Like, I can't bear the pain. I don't see an easy way out of this. And she listened to me. She was very upbeat. She doesn't ever feel sorry for me. And she said, "Paul, that might be true if you were alone, but you're not alone. You have me and you have AA, and you have everything you need to get through this." And she was absolutely right. That was the low water mark. And when I got on treatment and she helped me change my diet to reduce the inflammation, from that moment on, if you didn't see me in 2019, it's been a tremendous transformation of what it was like then and what it's like now. And, you know, there's been a lot of these sayings over the years, but one I really like, as they say, you could survive 30 days without food, you could survive 3 days without water, you could survive 3 minutes without air, but you can't survive long without hope. And I'm telling you, I have seen, and I have been down to some dark places where I just didn't see it happening, you know, coming out of it. But there is hope. And there are people who have been where I have been. There are people who have been where you have been. I think some of it is just trying to find that, opening up the doors to those connections. So one of the transformative things I've seen over and over again, I used to see it more in the cities, is I would be in a meeting and some homeless person would walk in and they're in psychosis. They've got like yellow eyes. They've been homeless for a long time. They have leaves and twigs in their hair. They have Jesus hair, the Jesus beard. They don't have shoes. They've got dirty clothes. People they can't talk in complete sentences. They're just, you know, kind of wild. And people are scared to sit beside them. And then I'll see them a couple days later, and they have clean clothes on. And then you'll see them a couple days later, and you know, they're a little bit better. And then, like, 6 months later, I've been chairing a meeting. At the end of it, I'm doing cord slips for people, and some person walks up, and he says, "Hi, Paul, how you doing?" I'm like, "I'm doing okay." And he said, "Do you know who I am?" I said, "No, I have no idea." He tells me, and I'm like, "I still have no idea. I don't think I've ever met you before." And he said, "Yeah, I'm Jesus, dude. You were sitting beside me at my first meeting." I'm like, "Holy crap, dude. Like, I can't even describe the transformation that's occurred." And I'm sure there's people that felt like I was that lost cause. Like, you're just never coming back, man. So there is some power here because I have seen it at work. And, you know, I have to deal with my mental illness in addition to recovery and to my health. It will take me out. And I've had problems with depression ever since I was young, anxiety. And the steps and having a network of people that I can tell on myself greatly aids me. You know, one of the things that really saved my life was my first sponsor, Al. He had gotten this coin when he finished Rangers Rip School, and he gave me this coin, and he said, "You got to promise me that you'll give this back to me before you pick up a drink." He said, "Promise me this." And I knew how important it was to him, and so I said, "Sure." And I had maybe 2 months, and I had like $50 on me, and I was at Fred Meyer's, and I was thinking, how much booze can I get for $50 in my pocket? And my first thought was, oh, shit, I told that guy. My first thought was, oh, I better get out of here before someone from AA sees me. And then my second thought was, oh, shit, I told that guy I'd call him before I drink. So I still thought I was going to drink, but I went to a payphone. This is before cell phones. I called him collect because I wasn't going to waste any of my $50 on him. And then I had a hard time kind of admitting what was going on. I just started talking about the Seahawks. And he's like, did you really call me collect to talk about the Seahawks? I said, no, I'm thinking about drinking. And he said, well, his first words to me were, what do you want me to do, come down there and hold your hand? And I said, fuck you. You told me to call before I picked up a drink. So I said, tell me where you are. I'll come down and pick you up and have a cup of coffee. If you want a drink after that, I'll buy you your first drink. And I thought, well, there's no way he's talking me out of it. So we'll do this. So we went. And this was the first time in my life that I had the obsession to drink. And I told on myself. And it got popped. He wasn't trying to convince me out of drinking. We just were talking. At the end of it, I didn't feel like drinking anymore. And that got easier and easier the more I told on myself. And it's one of the gifts of this program because I get obsessive. I mean, part of why I know I'm an alcoholic is when I start, I have no off switch. So if it doesn't have to be alcohol. If I suddenly decide I want to organize my fridge at 2 a.m., it's just, I'm going to do it. I can't stop myself. You know, whatever, I can easily get obsessed with things. And to me, that's the check engine light that something's off with me spiritually that I'm not dealing with, that I'm not able to sit with. And it's still, I still have that alcoholic mind of like, I need something to fix me instantly. You know, that instant gratification of how can I change this without changing me? You know, it's the idea of having to work at something or that it might take time has always been something that was difficult for me to come to terms with. My life today is so much different than it has been in the past. I have my dream job. I do what I love. I'm at the top of my career. I got a promotion this year, even though I have MS. I'm sure most of the folks that hired me knew I have MS. And most of the people in my life know I'm in recovery. I don't hide that from anybody. I love AA. I love the people in AA. It's a great example of how this works for me today. I got tasked this past week on Wednesday. The boss above me is vacant. And so they said, okay, Paul, you're going to have to go to this really highfalutin meeting with donors. You're going to have to represent this division. A lot of stuff I just don't know even anything about. And you've got to kind of schmooze with these people. And it's very daunting for me. It's very much out of my comfort zone, not something I enjoy doing. A lot of these people I don't know. So I go to this meeting, and I'm in my car, and I'm just feeling very afraid. And so I pray. I just pray to the universe and say, hey, this feels like it's more than I can deal with. And I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle the situation. And I said, your will be done. And so I walk in there. I don't suddenly have any more courage or any more wisdom or anything like that. I look around. I'm still anxious. And out of the 50 people at that meeting, who walks up and sits beside me but somebody I know from AA? And as soon as they sit down beside me, I just felt this weight lifted off my shoulders. We didn't talk about AA. I didn't tell them, I was nervous. It just happened. So I see these things quite a bit. I'll share a very personal story. I have struggled a lot with suicide, wanting to kill myself. And there's been a lot of suicide in my family. I've lost nine friends and family members to suicide over the years. And a lot of it was just brutal. It happened with no advance warning. I was out of foster care and living in Seattle. I was living with a woman who would be my second wife and the mother of my daughter. And we were going to community college at the time. And Out of the blue, one of my older foster brothers committed suicide, just shot himself. He was better looking. He just seemed like he had a... I thought if anybody would succeed, it was him. I may have been more intelligent than him, but otherwise, this guy was just better off. I struggled more with alcohol and drugs, all this other stuff. So when this happened, the news of this, it just seemed like all hope evaporated from my life. Because I was like, if that guy can't make it, I can't make it. And we're done. We're out of foster care. We're on our own. We're adults. And yet it seems like nothing's changed. You know, we're not better. We're not fixed. It's not going well. And so I just made my mind up, well, the only way out of this is to kill myself. And so one of my other brothers, I knew where he kept his gun, and he worked during the day. So I knew where he kept the key to his apartment. I just stopped by, let myself in, grabbed his gun, ate some of his cookies, looked through his mail. And I couldn't do it without having a couple of drinks. So I bought 2 40-ouncers of Old English 800. And I went up, it's the south side of Seattle, which is the housing projects. There's abandoned cars. And I had the gun between my legs and the 2 40-ouncers. And as fate would have it, that brother was not working that day. And he came back right after I left and found his gun was gone. He knew it was me. And he was at 7-Eleven buying cigarettes, and he ran into my girlfriend. And he said, hey, tell your boyfriend to bring back my gun. And she said, how do you know it was him? And he said, because he's the only person that knows the key to my house, this is where it's at. So right as I was finishing that second 40-ouncer, she shows up behind me in her car. She's dressed very nice. She's very out of place in this area. And I thought, oh, God, there's just no way she's going to talk me out of this. And she stands out there for a while. She's kind of thinking of what to say. And I feel really bad about kind of bringing her into this. And she leans down on the outside window and she says, you're a real fucker for letting me fall in love with a dead guy. And I said, yeah. I said, I don't think we get a pick who we fall in love with, but if you come to talk me out of it, it's not going to work. And she said, no, I didn't come up here to talk you out of it. She said, if you're in that much pain and you don't have any hope of changing, she said, I want you to know I love you so much that I understand. She said, I came up here to tell you goodbye. And with that, she turned around and walked off. And at that moment, I realized, well, it was about 30 seconds later, I realized that I had something that Bill didn't have. I had somebody that believed in me. And the profound nature of that is more important to me than love or trust or anything else. And I find that here in AA. There's this accountability of people will say, you know, come tomorrow meeting, don't drink between now and then. And I'm like, God, do you know who I am? Like, I can't do that, you know. There's this accountability and love that we put on people, believing in them. I can't tell you how many times there have been lost causes where they come in, and they're always really kind of oblivious to the fact that they're very close to never coming back. And I have, like, this love for them. And they're often kind of foul creatures. And I'm like, is this what it was like for me? You know, where people thought, God, this guy's just a lost cause. He's never coming back. Anyway, I am so grateful for that love and that connection and for what goes on in these rooms and for what you've taught me. So thank you very much.